My name is Rich Anderson, and I'm staff coordinator here at Holden. And a couple of the scheduled teaching staff did not come this week, so they're getting real desperate and asked Jackie and me and a few others to do some teaching of classes.
Who are we missing, by the way?
Who are we missing?
Yes.
I'd rather not tell. Anyway, I told Jody I'd be willing to talk about something that I've been working over and mulling around and trying to get organized. And so that's what we're going to do. Let me give you a little history. I'm a Lutheran minister and have been in private practice, pastoral counseling, marriage and family therapy for about 15 years in Minnesota. And for the last five of that, I've gotten pretty heavily involved in the chemical dependency area as well. And so a lot of what I'm going to say tonight or today, I think, is based on just my experience of doing that with clients. Some of the best teachers I've ever had have been clients who've come and paid me money to tell me things, and I've learned a lot. And I think some of this that I'm trying to put together and sort out in my own mind are things that they've taught me. I think what I'll try to do is present a little bit of material to you kind of quickly and give you a couple examples that I've learned from clients and people that I've dealt with, and then give you an opportunity to talk about and discuss maybe some of the things that are personal to you or things that you've experienced or ask some questions. And by no means along the way, if you have a question and you stop me and interrupt me, is it going to mess me up? So, I mean, this is not a formalized presentation. Just say, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Okay? Just some groundwork. I guess a couple of things I was trying to sort out and figure out is what spirituality is all about. I grew up in the Lutheran Church all my life. I was baptized and confirmed and married and ordained and spent all my life in the Lutheran Church. And then when I got involved in working with people that especially are alcoholics and are in 12-step recovery groups and they started talking about spirituality, I started learning a lot more things about what a person's spirit is all about and what spiritual relationships are all about. And I started finding out a lot of things about spirituality that I never learned in seminary or Sunday school or wherever. So a lot of the credit for many things that I've discovered and found out about I have to give to friends and people I know that are in recovery groups like AA, Al-Anon, adult children, and so forth. A couple of the things I just want to give as groundwork. I looked up, you know, I guess when you go to enough school, they teach you that you're not responsible unless you give definitions of words, and you of course go to the dictionary and you give those definitions, and then you all start with the same groundwork. So I looked up what spirituality was. And the dictionary says, something that is ecclesiastical law, something that in ecclesiastical law belongs to the church, or to a cleric as such. I didn't know quite what that meant. The second definition of spirituality I thought was an oxymoron. It says clergy. That's all it is. Yeah. The second definition of spirituality was clergy. The third definition was sensitivity or attachment to religious values. And I suppose, you know, in one sense maybe. The fourth one was the quality or state of being spiritual. That didn't make a lot of sense to me either. So I looked up spiritual. And spiritual means of or relating to or consisting of spirit. Yeah. Second one is of or relating to sacred matters. Yeah. And the third one I thought was real interesting. Of or related to supernatural beings or phenomenon. That got a little closer to what my expectations of what spiritual was some kind of relating to supernatural or extraterrestrial or something else. Anyway.
Something outside ourselves.
Yeah, something beyond us. But then you know, and that's what I've kind of grown up to believe, is that the spiritual is beyond us. In my process of working through this, I've discovered that I was wrong, that the spiritual is within us. And anyway, we'll get to that. I looked up Fred Buechner, who's a somewhat of a hero of mine, written a book called Wishful Thinking. And I'd like to just read a couple things from what he says. The word spirit has come to mean something pale and shapeless, like an unmade bed. School spirit, the American spirit, the Christmas spirit, the spirit of 76, the Holy Spirit. Each of these points to something you know is supposed to get you to your feet cheering, but which you somehow can't rise to. The adjective spiritual has become downright offensive. Somebody recommends a person as spiritual, you tend to avoid him, and usually with good reason. Inspiring is even worse. Inspirational is worse still. Inspirational books are invariably for the birds. Like its counterparts in Hebrew and Greek, the Latin word spiritus originally meant breath, as in expire, respiratory, etc. And breath is what you have when you're alive and don't have when you're dead. Thus, spirit equals breath equals life. The aliveness and power of your life, and to speak of a person's spirit or soul is to speak of the power of life that is within him or her. When the spirit of one is unusually strong, the life in him or her is unusually alive. They can breathe it out into other lives, become literally inspiring. Spirit is highly contagious. When one is excited, very happy, very sad, you can catch it as easily as measles or a yawn. But that's interesting. Then he went on to say, God also has a spirit, as spirit, capital S, says the Apostle John. Thus, God is the power of life itself, and has breathed and continues to breathe into creation, inspires it. The Spirit of God, Holy Spirit, Holy Ghost, is highly contagious. When Peter and his friends were caught up in it at Jerusalem on Pentecost, everybody thought they were drunk, even though the sun wasn't yet over the yardarm. They were. The end of his paragraph. And I think it's a real interesting paradox that we talk about alcoholic spirits as being alcoholic beverages. And that maybe the sense of intoxication or euphoria that we get from chemicals is somewhat similar, but in an artificial sense of being induced, to what we sometimes think of as a spiritual experience. Anyway, let me go on a little bit more. Another interesting quote that I wanted to read to you is from an article about Abraham Maslow. And Maslow was a psychologist, died, I believe, in the 70s at some point. And this is something about his life and some of the things that he was saying. This article is entitled Abraham Maslow and Transpersonal Psychology by Edward Hoffman. And it's out of a periodical called, I can't remember the periodical, but I can find it if you need it later. In concrete terms, Maslow felt that we all inwardly yearn to experience a sense of the sacred and the numinous. Some cultures, however, are more accepting of such needs than others. Ours is an extremely anti-spiritual culture. He believed, one whose materialistic outlook is so dominant that many, perhaps most people, feel ashamed to admit such longings, even to themselves. Typically, the media denigrate those who express tender, reverential feelings. Even worse, the media deliberately desacralize the holiness inherent in everyday life. For example, Maslow railed against the way in which friendship, marriage, and parenthood are ridiculed or debased on TV programs, network news, and the like, as well as the way in which love and sexuality are reduced to their lowest denominator in the sensationalist press. I hope nobody hears from the press or the media. Maslow observed, too, that institutional religion has lost its power to arouse, like earlier, Buechner was talking, inspire, has lost its power to arouse in us a sense of wonder, awe, and devotion. Churches and synagogues all too often are materialistically lavish but spiritually vacant. As a result, many Americans feel lost and adrift amidst a sea of cynical, materialist, and even nihilistic social philosophies. Well, I went on to dig around to see what else was available and came upon Jim Fowler. How many people here heard about, know something about James Fowler? Okay. Fowler is he a psychologist, would you say, who has done quite a bit of studying of developmental kinds of psychology, especially things like Erik Erikson, that I'm sure we all know, has set up certain stages of psychological emotional development. He studied people like Piaget, Lawrence Kohlberg, and Fowler has a book and developed a set of theories, and the book's entitled Stages of Faith. Fowler basically talks about our faith or our spiritual life or our belief in a external being greater than ourselves as something that grows and moves and develops. And I thought I'd give you some of that rather quickly just as some more groundwork. And I wrote some of it up here. What he says is that from 0 to 2 years of age, approximately, people develop or are existing in what's called an undifferentiated stage. It's really preconceptual, pre-linguistic, relatively unconscious. And at that age, of course, we're just developing senses of trust, autonomy, hope, and courage. But those are very spiritual, very theological kinds of concepts. Secondly, moving into the second stage, he talks about the intuitive projective stage, and he talks about children that are approximately 3 to 7 years of age. And this is one in which they develop imagination, have a lot of fantasy. They're powerfully influenced by examples, moods, actions, languages of adults. This is a stage where a lot of the biblical stories make a lot of sense to children, and they get caught up in them, and they're quite enamored by them. They tend to have no logical thought process, and this stage is really important in the sense that it produces long-lasting images and emotional memories for children. And I think, you know, it's quite obvious that our Sunday school and Christian education programs are focusing in on some of those stages. What I think is real important is that we need to be even more clear than we maybe have been in the past of how important it is in those stages that we develop positive and affirming images for children. The third stage is the mythical literal, and he says that runs roughly 8 to 13 years of age. And this is the one in which they take on the stories, beliefs, and observances that symbolize belonging to a community. It's a time in which they begin to get some sense outside of themselves that there's a larger group, a larger family, a larger community of faith, maybe called the church. Beliefs, moral rules, attitudes are appropriate with literal interpretation. They tend to be pretty literalistic about things, but they begin to develop rules and attitudes about how things, life is supposed to be lived. Story gives unity and value to experience, but they have no reflective conceptual meanings to the stories. They're just gradually starting to come out of being in the unconscious area of life. I have a 14-year-old, and he hasn't quite become conscious yet. But
still a kid.
But again, I'm a lot older than him, and I'm not sure I'm conscious very often.
Boys are slower, Rich.
That's right.
The next stage is synthetic conventional. Life spheres expand outside the family. These are the adolescent years. where from 14 to 18, developing relationships, learning to develop relationships are real important. The family becomes less important. Faith must provide a coherent and meaningful orientation for them between other relationships outside and family. Faith must synthesize values and information. Faith must unify identity and outlook. Fowler is pretty heavy on this stage as being extremely significant in spiritual growth and development for adults. And my sense is that's when we lose kids.
What happens if you've missed out on some of these? I mean, you know, if you didn't go through these, like if you didn't go through that stage at, say, 3 to 7 or something, okay. Or so if you had a traumatic, you know, if you had a very traumatic experience in your life, cut out.
Okay, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
And let's be real careful not to see this really the way I've drawn it out. I think what happens is that people maybe move like this, and then they may stop for a while, and then they may move like this. And I think it's, you know, it's possible you may skip a stage, or, you know, nobody kind of moves as nice and neat as a textbook. Yeah. You may come back to something later on, or you may have some unfinished business in a certain stage that hangs with you till you're 80 or whatever. It never works out as neat and clean as we lay it out in the book so far. But we'll get to just what you're talking about. In this synthetic conventional stage, again, it's kind of a conformist stage. They're acutely tuned to the expectations and judgments of significant others. And this begins the critical reflection period of how one's beliefs and values have formed and changed. They begin to question, they begin to sort out, they begin to doubt. We see a lot of blatant kind of rejection stuff going on. We see many times kids just trashing the church until they've had some time, and then they come back in their own terms. But I think that's a real important stage, and I think it's an incredibly difficult challenge for the church to deal with people in that stage in a productive, healthy kind of way. The next one is individuative, reflexive. This one here, essentially 19 years on into the early 20s, late adolescence, early adulthood. In this stage, he says, people take seriously the burden of responsibility for our commitments, our lifestyle, our beliefs, our attitudes. Tensions are seen always between being an individual and being a member of a group, between subjective feelings and objectivity and critical reflection, struggling constantly between this is how I feel, this is what the rest of the group is seeing, or trying to be objective about sorting things out. Between self-fulfillment, self-actualization, and service to other people, being to other people, caring for the broader community, and being committed to the relative versus a struggle with the possibility of an absolute. All that kind of turmoil, sort of back and forth sorts of things go on there. Self-identity and outlook. Worldview are differentiated from those of other people. You begin to form your own concepts and ideas. And here he sees an explicit system of meaning developing, which defines one sense of relationship to the ultimate. Symbols become translated into conceptual meanings. And he calls this the demythologizing stage, the one in which you kind of blow away all the stories and the myth and wrestle with chiseling down to what's the core basic issue for me and my belief about an ultimate being. Let's get rid of the junk and really face up to what's important. The next one is conjunctive. It's a time when people strive to unify opposites in mind and experience, recognize integrity and truth in positions other than their own. I think when you move into a conjunctive sort of stage, you're much more sorted out, got your own sense of theology and belief and faith much more settled, and you're more open and receptive and willing to listen to different beliefs, different perspectives, different alternatives, and can let them be different or even welcome them as alternatives that can help you enhance your own beliefs as well. You're not threatened by them. You don't have to argue your own in a defensive kind of way. You don't interpret things as they're saying I'm wrong and they're right, etc.
That sounds like the stage where kids all of a sudden realize their parents are smart.
Yeah.
They're smarter than they thought, anyway.
Yeah. This is a stage in which you live out your own commitments and beliefs by honoring that which is true in others' lives and that which is true in one's own life. There's a sense of critical recognition of one's social consciousness. You tend to live between an untransformed world and a transforming vision and loyalty. The further you tend to move along in that kind of a stage, the more sense of, I think, the kinds of things that Jerry Barney was talking the other night when he said, as Christians, we've been baptized, Good Friday has happened, Easter Sunday has taken place, we are forgiven. Now let's put that on the shelf and get on with what we're supposed to do here in the world. And I think the conjunctive kind of stage is really at that point. It's saying, I've got it figured out, I'm comfortable with my belief, I'm comfortable with my sense of God and my faith and my sense of being reconciled and forgiven. The issue of working my way into heaven is taken care of. Jesus did that for me. Now let's get on with how do I, as a Christian, fit into the global sense of Christian community, the global sense of community among all peoples and different faiths, and we as a community in the world take responsibility for the world. Perceptions of justice, outreach, readiness to sacrifice self for justice and in a spirit of love. I think the kind of a sense of getting more involved in social kinds of issues for the sake of truth and honesty and justice begins to be more of an impelling drive. And then the last stage talks about, well, Fowler says it's really rare to find anybody that's really attained that last sort of stage. He says it's a very disciplined, activist incarnation of the imperatives of absolute love and justice. It's a sense of being in the world as a transforming presence, but not of the world. It's a sense of oneness with all persons. It's a felt sense of the ultimate as inclusive of all beings. A person in the universalizing stage of spiritual growth is seen as subversive of structures of society. Social structures and whatever would see this person as threatening and dangerous. And certainly the church probably would. This person is sometimes an affront of our own pragmatism, realism, our usual notions of relevance. Maybe even our usual notions of reverence. They may appear sacrilegious, irreverent, but definitely not irrelevant. And frequently these people become martyrs to the vision that they incarnate, even in the hands of those whom they hope to change. And then he listed a few examples like Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Bonhoeffer, Jesus, Mother Teresa. Anyway, I don't want to belabor that. I think it's a real interesting sort of perspective. And I think that the more I read it and understood it, the more sense it made to me that, yes, we tend to do that. We tend to move along and we tend to grow in our spiritual development. Then as I was working with a lot of people, I guess in counseling, I started trying to take this sort of a system and help people sort out where they are in this continuum. And my thinking was that, well, if you could help somebody kind of see where they are and get a sense of where they need to go, and you can kind of look at some of the directions that can help them move on down the road, that would be beneficial to them. And what I discovered in an awful lot of people was that they were stuck, which is just what you're talking about. And I found an awful lot of people stuck down in these two stages. In 3, 7, 8 to 13 stages. And they might be 20, 40, 80 years old, but spiritually they were 9. And when I start to ask them some more and start to poke around and probe and work at getting them to get some earlier recollections about their past church experience and their past Sunday school experience and their past home experience and their family devotional or religious or whatever kind of experiences, started coming up with some pretty bizarre stories, things that I couldn't quite sort out. And one that I remember was a woman who told me, and actually this woman showed up after church one Sunday. She wasn't even a consulee, and I had been preaching a sermon. And I preached a sermon, I'm trying to remember what it was. I don't listen to my own sermons like most people don't. You know. It was something about the will of God and how my concept of the will of God was that God doesn't just manipulate us like pawns, and God doesn't make things that are awful happen. And I tried to sort out the whole concept of the retribution dogma in Job, that God doesn't bless the righteous and punish the unjust. God doesn't work that way. And she came up to me afterwards and she told me, I've been roaming around looking for a church and I just dropped in here today. And she said, in the past 30 some years, I've never heard a minister say that. And I want to tell you that I've quit going to church for about 20 years and have started coming back trying to look for some place to go. And the more I talked to her, the more we found out that she was really angry at ministers and she hated God and she didn't want anything to do with ministers, God, and the church, but she knew there was something missing and she was really looking. And then she started telling me about when she was 9 or 10 years old, she had had a baby brother born who was born mentally retarded. And she, at 9 years old, just couldn't understand why her darling, lovable little baby brother that she had waited for 8 or 9 months, was born in such a situation. And apparently, their family sat down with their minister or the minister came over or whatever, but her recollection was, I remember a minister telling me that it was God's will that my brother was born mentally retarded and that God had a purpose in my brother's spending the rest of his life in a bed, groaning and never being able to move and not even knowing what's going on in life. And she said, I decided if that's what God does to people, I don't want anything to do with that God. And I've hated that God ever since, and I don't want to talk to clergy or go to church, but I don't know what to do because I know there's something more. You know, and at that point, I mean, she was in tears, and it was a real difficult, painful kind of experience for her. And from that, kind of come around to discovering, I think, that there's such a thing as spiritual abuse. I worked a lot with people that have been physically abused, people that have been sexually abused, people that have been verbally or emotionally or psychologically abused. I never thought that people could be spiritually abused, but I think it happens all the time. And obviously, this woman at a really impressionable stage in her life and in her spiritual growth and her psychological development heard something said by somebody whose intentions I'm sure were pure and very good, that was extremely painful to her and literally shut her down at that point. It's no different, I don't think, than if someone had taken a baseball bat up along the side of her head or raped her. Her experience with that spiritual abuse was no different than if she had been raped physically. And all the dynamics tend to be the same. And the more I started asking people about this, the more I found out that people just had tons and tons of stories, horror stories, about growing up in the Catholic Church with nuns who would beat them if they didn't memorize their Bible verses. And on and on and on. People, a good friend of mine back home who grew up in the Lutheran Brethren Church, and he talked about a lot of very, very rigid, strict, moral kinds of things, and developing an absolute fear of God to the point where when he came into the individuative kind of reflexive stage, he just chucked it all too. He said, I don't want to go to church and constantly be afraid. And he had a whole bunch of struggles that he's still working with, and he's 40. He's not dead yet, but he's 40. Anyway, so then I just want to give you a few more things, and then I want us to talk about this. I looked up abuse, and it was real interesting in the dictionary. It said it's a corrupt practice or custom. Or number two, it's an improper use of treatment. Or it's number three, it's a deceitful act or deception. Or then they said number four, abusive language or physical maltreatment. Or they called it to use so as to injure or damage.